Alyssa Quart is the author of the book Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, and Branded, The Buying and Selling of Teenagers. She's the executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her new book is Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. The book is an unsparing, incisive, yet ultimately hopeful look at how we can shed the American obsession with self-reliance that has made us less healthy, less secure, and less fulfilled. The promise that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps is central to the story of the American dream. It's the belief that if you work hard and rely on your own resources, you will eventually succeed. However, time and again, we have seen how this foundational myth, with its emphasis on individual determination, brittle self-sufficiency, and personal accomplishment, does not help us. Instead, as income inequality rises around us, we are left with shame and self-blame for our own condition. Again, the name of the book is Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. It is published by Echo, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Alyssa Quart back to the program. Is that your ride?
Yeah, exactly. You know that I'm not in the wonderful Berkshires of the Catskills right now, but I have called that home at times. Thank you so much for having me on, Joe.
It's a delight to have you back. And this book is so important and just really so incisive and ultimately hopeful, I think. And I'm interested what brought you to the subject ultimately of this idea of how we can get wrapped up in believing the propaganda, if you will, of the American dream.
Yeah, I mean, I run this nonprofit, right? The Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which I co-created with Barbara Ehrenreich, the late great author. Mm. And we get a lot of emails and comments, and I've gotten them also from my previous books, which also dealt with poverty, about the kind of fault that we put on people who are struggling economically and emotionally in this country. Notes like, why did one of our writers go to college? Why didn't they go to college? Why do they own their own home? Why don't they? Why are they having kids with different guys or not married or what have you? Like, there's always this tendency for a certain group of Americans to blame Americans who are struggling. And I was sort of struck by the venom of these comments and like that it was always fault was always placed back on the individuals at hand. And so I wanted to take a look at what were these myths behind the fact that we're supposed to be able to make it on our own. What was the Horatio Alger story really about? And so I went on a journey to find out.
Where did you start the journey?
You know, it was during the pandemic, and I was in Socrates. Shout out to Socrates.
All right, go Socrates.
And yeah, all right, exactly. And, you know, part of it was a personal journey. You know, I learned a lot, as a lot of people did during the pandemic, about how much I depended on others, and including essential workers and my personal community, but, you know, a broader community, you know, what sometimes is called imagined communities. So I was very dependent on those during the pandemic, as many of us were. But then I also started to read some of these classics, you know, the Horatio Alger novels, Emerson, Thoreau, Ayn Rand again, Laura Ingalls Wilder even. And I sort of went on an intellectual journey as well into what these founding myths were about.
So let us start with those founding myths of when they came to us and when they became listened to and I guess ultimately believed.
Okay, so in 1834, about both the terms, the idioms, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and self-made man, they were both coined in that time. And it's interesting because there's a time of, right, great ingenuity, you know, people starting to create companies, steamboats, all this kind of thing. And that's part of it, right? It was this kind of self-propulsion in terms of business. But it was also, they were jokes. I mean, in 1834, when people talked about Bootstrap, they recognized that it was actually about a local inventor, and they were mocking him. They're like, he's going to next, he'll try to pull himself up by his bootstraps, because no one can actually pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Right.
I actually tried, because I was writing this book. I was like, okay, what would that look like? And I was like, you know, Simone Biles could do this. I'm not going to be able to do this. But it was like many things in America, it starts out as a parody and an absurdity, and then it gets normalized and naturalized into like a quasi-religion. And that's what happened with that phrase. So pull yourself up by your bootstrap means something very different in 1905 and, you know, 1984 than it did in 1834.
When you, again, I asked that question about when people started to believe it, but the idea that it becomes something that is part of the American dream, that is something that is possible in this country, that all you have to do is have a little self-determination and you can make it work out. I mean, there's many ways of me asking this question, but I guess the most simple way is, you know, has there ever been a time, I mean, there's certainly been people who have done it, but has there ever been a time where that has been a foolproof strategy?
I mean, no. I mean, that's not to say that hard work and accomplishments are all for naught. You know, I mean, it takes, I know this from my earlier book, it takes 10,000 hours to get mastery in a skill, 10,000 hours of doing something. Many people have worked really hard for what they have. But at the same time, if we look at contemporary mobility numbers, you know, someone born in the 1980s has like a 50% chance roughly of equaling their parents in terms of mobility. And if they had been born in the 1940s, they had like a 92% of exceeding their parents or equaling their mobility. So honestly, today we have a lower chance of mobility. We have CEOs paid 399 times as much as typical workers and making on average like $60 million in 2021, whereas that we know what the average worker is making. It's a huge amount less. And it's just right now that determination myth is not working for a lot of people, and instead it's inducing them to like blame themselves every time they can't quite make it. And I hope my book, Deconstructing These Myths in Part, will take away some of the shame and self-blame.
You talk about that, of how we steered away from social programs that would address the root causes of our problems. And in some way, because we thought that the answer was just to work a little harder, do a little bit more.
Yeah. And it was, you know, there is a whole culture of voluntarism, right, in both the positive and negative. But, you know, Clara Barton, right, like the Red Cross, you know, hand up, not a handout. All the way up to Bush 1, you know, 1,000 points of light, right? That charity would right. take care of everything, philanthropy. And, you know, when I looked into the numbers of countries that had great social safety nets, they had just as robust charity nets as well, as it were. People were volunteering at the same rate, sometimes more. So there was no real correlation. I think part of the American story is that we're going to lose our charity or our sense of giving if we actually supported people adequately. But internationally, that doesn't wash. It's just not accurate.
What is it about? Obviously, you get into experience, you get into education, you get into a lot of factors that put people into the position of where they're able to go next, of where they're able to rise and or fall as a result of their circumstances. And of course, we all know that that's not a all things are created equal equation by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, it's really not. And part of what I do in the book, when I talk to many, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of people in the book, and I'm looking at the history, but I'm also looking at the present, and I'm looking at people who didn't have inherited money to start with. And that's, you know, often, you know, people of color, and people who haven't had the same playing field, you know, women workers who are mothers who are paying the, you know, motherhood penalty for having kids, which is a known thing. And we can't just assume that everybody has the same chance, which is a sort of American obsession to think that that's the case. It's just not true. And in my work at EHRP, I also see that that's not true. I mean, which doesn't mean that we don't have some control of, over our story. We do, but we just need to, really work to separate ourselves from that obsession.
I'm interested in, you touched on this, but the Horatio Alger Association of Distinguished Americans. Talk to us a little bit about this, of this group and what you wanted to dig into and find out about as you investigated them and their work.
Yeah, so the Horatio Alger group, some of their, it's like a rogues gallery of who has won this award. Clarence Thomas was distributed the prizes, but also somebody who has had a tycoon who had multiple OSHA violations. Ronald Wanick has also won some kind of Horatio Alger award, and so had Reagan, Ronald Reagan. But the point of the award isn't just the problem with it itself, it's the problem with Horatio Alger. So when you go back and look at his book, first of all, the Horatio Alger story wasn't actually a story of somebody making it. It was a story of young men, young teenagers really, intersecting with wealthy older men. So even the Horatio Alger story isn't quite as one might think. And then Horatio Alger's biography was just riddled with scandal. I mean, he was a pedophile. He had been run out of the church. He'd been originally a minister, and then he became this author, but he was still kind of going on the Bowery and meeting, Thebes young men. So there's kind of a lot of darkness there in the story. And I'm sort of shocked that he hasn't been canceled and that this award is still given out with such joy. And people, Donald Trump referred to his father as a Horatio Alger story. I mean, this is like at the highest level. And this guy was like a miscreant.
Forced to resign from Harvard Divinity School, being accused of molesting two boys. So certainly great questions brought up. The idea, though, and then things started that those ideas started to go on because people were obviously given this prize, but also other people were getting in on a similar argument, a similar idea, a frame. And that is it's one of those things that you talk about, especially for students. Realize that, well, all things are not created equal, number one, and number two, that it's really difficult to be put in that position that would be the starting gate, if you will, of what they're talking about in these groups.
Yeah, it's really hard to get there. And, people like Ayn Rand, who preached this this gospel also, and, it's still loved by technologists, right, who all name their boats after the fountainhead or whatever
right.
on their yacht. But Ayn Rand wound up on Social Security and Medicare in the last years of life. So we find that many of the people even who made it by these terms wind up dependent at some point. So the point I'm trying to make in the book overall is that we should actually, instead of being ashamed of the ways that we're dependent, even celebrate it. And I had called that the art of dependence. And that being dependent, I mean, not in every element of our lives, but in the ways that we're dependent on others is a form of grace. And it's a craft and a skill to be dependent on others. So, I mean, that's the biggest takeaway, I think, from the book. And there's so many stories in it, individuals that I talk to, fascinating people who sort of illustrate the beauty of community and depending on others. And then people who illustrate the pain, really, of being isolated and in this Horatio Alger story and striving.
You talk about the overemphasis of individual responsibility and talk about how there's this idea that we have a social safety net, dystopian is how you put it.
Yeah.
So and then you go on to talk about how GoFundMe fundraising, where someone will go solicit funds from their friends and their families and other people to deal with things that are, you know, whether it's your medical bills or to save you a car payment, of what impact that has on people and how they view what their responsibilities are.
Yeah, so GoFundMe has become a social service, and that's the point I'm making. It's the medical expenses piece is like the biggest, one of the biggest sectors of GoFundMe, you know, to the point where, like, the guy who runs or founded GoFundMe said, we weren't ever set up to be a healthcare company, and we still are not. But he had to address this in 2019 because there was, you know, 11 million Americans said they had had catastrophic expenses. And, you know, there was, you know, that GoFundMe was supposed to be addressing, right? I call it the dystopian social safety net because I'm trying to explain the organizations, the crowdfunding sites, but also like the nonprofits, if you will, that exist. And it's great they exist, but it's also tragic that they have to exist. You know, like there's a parking lot. I worked on a film about this, a parking lot in California, a couple of them where homeless folks live, unhoused folks live, or they sleep there overnight. And it's great that these parking lots exist, right? But it's also, it is the dystopian social safety net that we have to depend on people who run parking lots to house people, right? Like that is, in a sense, the job of government is to have adequate housing, housing justice, right? And then if you don't have that, to have housing, you know, temporary housing that is created by our state and local government, not by these nonprofits or Walmart. A lot of people live in the Walmart parking lots too. So that is a dystopian social safety net.
Like No Man Land, right? I mean, that's what we were talking
about
in
that
film.
Yeah, that's totally it. And then, you know, but sometimes even darker. Yeah.
Well, right. That's a Hollywood movie. I mean, yes, yeah. Absolutely. But that still is gritty and thinking that this is a like a solution to a problem, which I guess it is, but it's not a good solution.
No, and I wanted to play that in the book. I sort of discuss this tension between things that are, you know, like volunteerism is great, right? And mutual aid, I'm writing in support of these programs, but I'm also sort of, there is a element, they're edged by the tragedy that they have to exist. And many of the people I talked to who volunteered, you know, made masks and did COVID tests in parking lots, also with unhoused people, all for free, right? They were volunteers. They were saying like, I shouldn't have to do this. This is, you know, as much as they felt great about the fact that they were giving like this, they also felt like there's something fundamentally wrong about it. And that ambiguity is because, you know, we're not being adequately supported. We're not supporting our citizens adequately.
You write in the book, the pandemic acted like a proverbial X-ray machine, exposing how self-defeating or isolation from one another can be. The pandemic also exposed with the clarity of medical imaging how dependent we are on one another. Talk about where we are right now and what we do from here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to let go entirely of the things we learned during the pandemic. And I think that's a point I'd like to make. Like, I was in the Socrates during the pandemic, and I saw a lot of community. I mean, someone came over and brought yeast and baked bread, you know. We get together in fields. I'm sure you probably did this too, Joe. And, yeah. You know, there was a greater respect for low-wage workers. They were called essential. They were called frontline. They were given hazard pay. There were mutual aids. There were people who were bringing bird seed to my parents in the Berkshires, you know. And it was just like there was a community that was forming around that. And then in terms of social services, the bar was lowered for people to get SNAP and to get recertified for things like Medicaid, right? And that is with an eviction moratoria, too, that protected people's housing during the pandemic. And so I don't want to let go of what we learned, because in a sense, I feel like it would be in vain. And how do we keep that knowledge going? How do we sustain the memory of it, you know, without the trauma of it, I guess, and honor the what we learned from it. And that, to me, is what we need to keep doing. And that's part of why I wrote this book.
The name of the book is Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. It is published by Echo. Alyssa Court, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Oh, you too, Joe. And I just want to mention, I'm giving a reading with Kim Cutter in Hudson at Spotty Dog on the 31st at 7. So everyone in that area should come.
31st at 7 at Spotty Dog, one of our favorite places. Alyssa, thank you so much for being with us. Best of luck.
Oh, thank you again, Joe. It's wonderful. Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.